Welcome. You're listening to FemWonk. I'm your host, Katie Davey, and I'm on a mission to raise the policy discussion around gender and inclusion. This will be our last episode during the 2019 federal election campaign. It feels weird to say that. Canada has a fixed election date, which means as soon as one election is done, we can sort of start counting down the days until the next one. So after both weeks and honestly years of anticipation, it's nearly over. And today we're going to give you some general thoughts on the overall election campaign, some fun definitions in case we end up in a minority government situation, and then we're going to dive into the weeds on gender and this campaign, particularly focusing on platforms. Hope you enjoy. So this election has been a weird one. That's probably the understatement of the year. Although I can't necessarily quote you the election results of every election in Canada and the US history like my friend Jordan O'Brien can, but I have been heavily involved in a number of campaigns over the last 5 or so years. And I've got to say, I really feel like the more things change, the more they stay the same. And this is true for all sides of the political coin. We really do take our cues from our neighbors to the south. As much as we pretend that we're not influenced by the US, it's undeniable that their politics and culture affect us. And this election really isn't about Scheer taking a page out of Doug Ford's playbook, but rather Scheer borrowing the playbook that Donald Trump gave to Doug Ford. But it's the same on the left. I would say maybe less so this time around, but it's undeniable that in 2015, Trudeau was running on the Obama legacy of hope. And in some ways, this is what Singh is doing this time around. All this to say, campaigns these days really are all the same, it feels like. Many people cite the nastiness of politics these days, and particularly attack ads, but if you ask any pollster, they'll tell you that they work. So why is that, is the question I have, and I think the unfortunate reality is it says more about us than it does about the parties putting them out there. If they work, if these attack ads work, if this nasty campaigning works to kind of change the narrative and to change people's minds, then you know, parties are just going to keep doing that. So we've really got to get above this nastiness and above the rhetoric into some real meaningful conversations. Okay, anyways, this is not Philosophize with Katie. All right, where are we at? We're honestly a few days until the election officially wraps up. Polls are nearly as tight as they have been really since the start of the campaign, except for the surge in the NDP and Bloc support. Nobody has really any ideas how things are going to shake out, but I've been surprised to learn that every person on Twitter seems to have an intimate understanding of how Westminster democracies work and how good or bad, or insert other word here, the election results will be. And many have been speculating that this election will deliver a minority government for months. But what does that mean? Well, luckily, or unfortunately, depending on who you ask, I too, like my friends on Twitter, have a bit of an expertise here. And no, it's not because I was fortunate enough to take out thousands of dollars of student debt to get a degree in political science. But because about a year ago to the day, I was in the thick of negotiating confidence in New Brunswick. It took nearly 6 weeks for Blaine Higgs to gain confidence of the House, and those middle 6 weeks were just as exhausting as the 6 weeks before that. The great news is, though, that everyone in New Brunswick got a crash course in our system of governments, so there's that. But before we get into really the meat of the episode and kind of the platforms and talking about how gender has been covered in this election, I decided I would share some definitions with folks that I think are important as we lead into the final days of this campaign and what could be a lovely minority situation. So first, the difference between a majority versus a minority. So this, I think, is a common misconception in our system, which is just because you have the most seats doesn't mean that you are the government. So a majority is when one party not only has more seats than all the other parties, but it also has a plurality of those seats. So in Canada, we have 338 seats, which means for one party to gain a majority, it needs at least 170 members of parliament to be elected. So a minority means that one party basically has the most seats, but it does not have at least 170 seats. So to govern, the minority party would need to be supported by other parties during any vote of confidence. It's also possible for the party with the most seats to not form a minority government if they're still able to put together support from other parties. Right now, you have minority situations in BC, New Brunswick, and PEI, and they're all very interesting examples and different and unique on their own. We actually did an episode on this a while back now, so check out episode 15 if you want to hear more about that. Next definition. So what's a confidence vote? That's a great question. Three things can be confidence votes. So one, the speech from the throne. Two, any bills that are money bills, so like a budget, and any bill or vote that the governing party deems a confidence vote. So the governing party stands up and says, should we make Halloween a national holiday? This is a vote of confidence. That would be a confidence vote. And if a government loses a confidence vote, then their government loses the confidence of the House and they fall. So what we saw in both BC and New Brunswick in the past few years was that the governing Liberals who were re-elected as a minority went to the House with a speech from the throne to test to see if they had the confidence of the House, and in both cases, they did not. So who gets to actually test the confidence first? So in Canada, the Prime Minister or the Premier holds that role until they resign or lose the confidence of the House, even after an election. So in a majority situation, if the governing party is not the party with the plurality of seats, they'll resign. This is typically on election night. You know, you see kind of the media cut over to the speech, and they'll give a resignation. But in a minority situation, if the governing party thinks that they can still gain the support of the House or gain the confidence of the House, the governor general or the lieutenant governor will allow them to do that first. So that leads into, what role does the governor general or the lieutenant governor play? Well, not only do they issue the writs of the election, but they invite the successful party to attempt to form a government. If that party is unsuccessful, the governor general may ask the party with the next highest amount of seats to attempt to form a government. Again, this is what you saw in both BC and in New Brunswick. And if a government still cannot be formed and they kind of exhaust all options, technically we'd be back to the polls. Okay, so now you're all experts in the event of a potential minority situation next week. I will say this is the Coles Notes version, so it's obviously a little bit more complex than my kind of 3-minute overview, but these are important terms, and we unfortunately don't really talk about them as much as we should. And again, that was something I really learned in New Brunswick, was that so few people really knew how the legislature worked, and, you know, in this case, how the House of Commons works. So it'll be interesting to see if we are using some of these phrases and words in the next few days. Okay, so I've given you basically all the election commentary I've got in me right now. I will say this has been a particularly hard campaign to observe. I found it hard to be on Twitter, especially over the last few days. It actually made me really sad that we've gotten, or maybe I've gotten, to a place where so many recent elections have had such a serious impact on my mental health. So, I mean, maybe we need to do kind of a self-care and politics episode, but I would say I'm really feeling it right now, and it's hard to even kind of provide some of this commentary. So thank you for bearing with me. Okay, let's get into gender and the campaign / platforms. So gender has popped up in various ways throughout the campaign, some good, some bad. I would say let's start with a huge win. All parties are running more women than they did in 2015. In 2015, 33% of people running identified as women. In 2019, that number is 42%. So nearing parity. And honestly, a 9% jump is quite good and quite impressive. So fingers are crossed that we can break that 27% we have right now this time around and really get a larger representation of both women and folks with diverse backgrounds and other diverse lived experiences into the House of Commons. We've also heard from the Liberals and the Conservatives about their plans for parental leave benefits. The Conservatives say that they'll make parental leave benefits tax-free, and the Liberals say that they would ensure that all new mothers would have access to 1 year of paid maternity leave or what they're calling a guaranteed parental leave. It's hard for families to get by with the current maternity leave benefits, if they even receive them. So I think both of these proposals would have benefits. Based on my own personal experience, though, I've definitely heard more women, particularly small business owners, express how hard it is to have kids when they don't have access to parental leave. I think overall, adapting our current parental leave systems to the realities of the day is an important step, and I'm glad the conversations are starting. It's a fairly complex system, to be honest, and you don't really take interest in it until you are either, you know, thinking of having kids or in that situation. So I think it's important that we have that conversation on how to make it a more inclusive system overall. On the other end of the spectrum, we've continued to hear a lot about abortion services during this election period, but I've really yet to hear a single meaningful commitment. Should we be worried about access under a conservative government? Yes, and I've detailed why I think that a number of times, particularly the fact that it would or could empower local governments, or rather provincial governments, to not necessarily roll back services, but not take to heart what accessible truly means. But I just have such a hard time with parties using abortion as a wedge issue. It really frustrates me. And I think the main reason is because women's reproductive care goes far beyond abortion access. And as a New Brunswicker, I've had personal experience with accessing women's health care and the barriers that that I face personally to that. But we hear nothing about these challenges. We hear a lot about healthcare, but there's not a gendered difference in healthcare in these conversations. And that's beyond, you know, your standard women's reproductive care. We're not hearing at all about, LGBTQ specific care. We're not hearing about intersectionally informed care, healthcare. I honestly just want to be in a place where we can demand more of our leaders than simply ensuring that a fundamental right to abortion access, as outlined by the Supreme Court of Canada, is upheld. The other side of that coin, though, is if we can't ensure a basic right to life, liberty, and security of person, then how can we have these other conversations? So it's tough, but I've been so frustrated to see the issue be used as a wedge issue rather than having meaningful conversations about improving, improving, but taking a more gendered specific approach and a gender responsive approach to healthcare. We've had lots of snippets of other policies, predominantly targeting women, including childcare and expanded Canada Pension Plan. But it feels like largely women have been left out of this election, and furthermore, LGBTQ peoples as well, particularly, again, the mainstream dialogue. So we dug into the platforms to see what the commitments are by parties, the ones that haven't been covered by the media, the ones we're not hearing a lot of attention about, or if any exist at all in some cases. We get into the nitty-gritty a little bit, we get into the weeds. You know, I love digging deep into some of these things. These are some of my favorite episodes. I will say, though, I looked at 5 platforms. So we did the Green Party, Liberal Party, NDP, Conservatives, and the Bloc. It's a lot of commitments, there are a lot of pages, and I am a one person, so please forgive me if I do accidentally miss something or skim over something that you might have wanted to hear a bit more about. I'd be happy to engage in a dialogue kind of offline afterwards about those issues, just please, yeah, feel free to flag them to me. And like I said, apologize if I miss anything or skim over. One person going through nearly, I'd say, 500 pages of commitments. It was a lot. It was a lot. Let's get into it. And really, there's no rhyme or reason to this. Let's go. So let's start with the Liberal Party, because they are coming out of government. They have an entire section titled Promoting Equality and Diversity. And they have a number of different things included in this, ranging from improved gender-based analysis plus, diversity in leadership, ending gender-based violence, sexual and women's health, LGBTQ2 equality, ending racism, access to justice, and ending extremism. It's widely a grab bag, to be honest, but if all of these areas are implemented in a meaningful way, they could have strong impacts. They also do have a loose commitment, and the language is a bit weird. They state to continue to work towards implementing the recommendations for the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls report. This actually is a commitment that is in at least 4 of the 5 platforms. So I think that is a positive. But again, each platform does kind of word their commitment a little bit differently. They also have an angle and kind of a commitment about moving forward with investments to support the United Nations peacekeeping efforts to help advance the women, peace, and security agenda. I think that's important to have in there. How Canada contributes globally is something that's important, and it's not just about taking leadership at home. The other thing that the Liberal Party does, and I think that they are the only party that does this, is include a gender equality statement. This is similar to what they've done, what they've started to do rather, in their budgets, where they include kind of, yeah, exactly what it sounds like, a gender equality statement. The thing I find so impactful about this, to be honest, is even, you know, though they have woman 35 times in their platform, this gender equality statement reinforces their commitment to, if they are elected, to putting every single policy through a gender-based analysis plus, which they, again, did for the 4 years that they were in government. And I think that it had a wide and measurable impact. So I think that gender equality statement is a real gem. And I would like to see parties overall start taking that type of approach. So next up, the Greens. They have really a number of kind of wide-ranging commitments, but they do focus quite heavily and specifically on implementing the calls to action in the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and also the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. They really do have kind of a wraparound commitment to ensuring that the recommendations be implemented. They have used in many ways the kind of language and the recommendations in other of their commitments, including they link transportation actually to the commitment in the Missing and Murdered Indigenous Women and Girls report, in addition to kind of the other pieces of it. So they say Canada must have access to reliable transportation options at affordable rates. Besides reducing pollution, this measure responds to the findings of the inquiry into missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. So again, obviously this is widely positive. And as I mentioned earlier, many of the platforms do include some commitment to the implementations of the inquiry, but again, this one is quite strong. They also, again, have some of these kind of smaller random commitments that you don't see in other platforms. So increased pay to rural and suburban postal workers who are predominantly women and have underpaid and are underpaid rather compared to mostly male urban counterparts. They also want to support research on equity, diversity, and inclusion in scientific research, or rather that kind of commitment that exists to include full participation of equity-seeking groups, where they include women, visible minorities, Indigenous people, and people with diverse gender identities. They too reference the needs of childcare and universal childcare as a way for women to really ramp up their work forced participation, and they commit to ending gender-based violence, which is essentially what their entire Advancing Gender Equality section is about, which I find that's a bit odd that it has been kind of targeted down just to gender-based violence, not just to gender-based violence, rather gender-based violence is incredibly important and all parties should be committed to ending it, but it is interesting that they chose that to be the sole issue in their Advancing Gender Equality section. They do have, though, an additional section entitled Protecting Sex Workers. And I will say, I did not see a strong commitment to protecting sex workers in any of the other platforms. But they link kind of labor rights for sex workers, which is incredibly important. But then they also talk about how establishing a guaranteed livable income could provide an economic alternative for folks pursuing sex work, which is interesting to me because, as you may recall, a few episodes back, we did a basic income episode, and I don't recall this language being in their platform in that iteration. I think it's interesting, and I think it's important that we talk about protecting sex workers, but like I said, I thought it was kind of an interesting way for them to form their argument, I guess. Okay, up next, the Conservative Party of Canada platform. They mention the word woman 8 times, however, only 3 times without saying men and women. So for example, they say things like, Justin Trudeau has repeatedly attacked Canadian's energy sector and the thousands of men and women who work in it. So honestly, when that is used as men and women, I'm kind of throwing it out. That's because it's not a gender-specific commitment. So they have a commitment to better support new arrivals to Canada. They want to continue to support newcomers, particularly for vulnerable newcomers such as women and girls and members of the LGBTQ plus community, which I think that is interesting that they have that commitment. They do use words solely, they do use basically immigration solely as the words rather than using words like refugee, even though this commitment very much feels like a refugee commitment. So I don't know if that was intentional or not. I would think it is, but knowing that they would continue Canada's commitment to resettling vulnerable newcomers is important, particularly in our current climate of resettlement. They also do have a commitment on missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. It is as follows. We will also develop a national action plan to address the ongoing tragedy of missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. So, okay, develop a national action plan. I think that's a bit of a soft commitment, but it's in here. And the third time they specifically mention women is here where they say, when we align our domestic values of protecting religious minorities, ensuring equality of women and girls, and championing Canadian values, we not only achieve results of our own country, but we contribute to global peace and security. So that is, again, in relation to their global commitment. The NDP are strong runners-up to the Liberal Party, both literally and in this case. They use the word woman 33 times in their platform. And they, too, have a number of different commitments, ranging from areas of foreign policy to, again, implementing the inquiry into missing Indigenous women and girls, and expanding things like employment insurance and other important services. They do call out kind of federal leadership on childcare, and they talk about implementing affordable, accessible, quality childcare, and that they will step up to provide leadership on that file. They do talk about also helping to ensure that it is simpler for young people and women to get into the agriculture business and build life on a farm. I thought that was kind of interesting. I, again, didn't see much of that in other platforms. So, I thought that was an interesting kind of addition. They also really hit the nail on the head with pay equity. So they use language, Right now, Canadian women make 32% less than men, and the gap is even wider for racialized women, Indigenous women, immigrant women, and women with a disability. A new Democratic government will prioritize pay equity. So again, that I think is really important. Not only are they calling it the issue and calling it the intersectionality of the issue, but they're making a strong commitment to pay equity, which again is a fundamental human right. And they also have a commitment to tackling obstacles for women's political participation by reforming the electoral system and introducing legislation to encourage political parties to run more women candidates. I think that's kind of interesting coming from the NDP because they have 49% of their candidates running in this election are women. So they, you know, are ahead of the curve. So it's interesting to see that they have that commitment broadly, but I think again important and not many, I didn't see that represented in many platforms. I did do as well Bloc Québécois, and the reason I did that is, as we mentioned earlier in the episode, there's a strong possibility of a minority situation, and the Bloc has surged quite a bit in the last few days and are now tracking to perhaps even have the third most seats of any party. So I think it's important to also look at what they're doing, or what they've committed to on gender equality. They talked about a women's entrepreneurship strategy, which I liked. They also call out themselves as a party as being pro-choice. So again, that, as we've mentioned, has been an issue in this election overall. And then they too have a commitment to incentives for parties to get more women elected. So you can definitely see some synergies there from what we've mentioned. So I think overall, you know, their platform is only kind of 24 pages. So I would give them a neutral grade. I would say, you know, those three things that I mentioned are strong steps forward. However, the Bloc does support Bill 21, which is the bill that bans religious symbols in public sector jobs. So that obviously has a significant gendered impact. So I think because they so overtly support that as a party, it's really hard to give them a passing grade. And I just don't think that that is something that we're comfortable with. I know you guys love, as much as I do, my blurt out episodes. So like I said, five parties, we just threw a lot on the table there. But I do want to give special attention to a few audience questions that we got. And I did mention it throughout the kind of analysis here, but we were asked, one, how parties stack up on violence against women. I think broadly, like I mentioned, there is a broad consensus that implementing recommendations from the inquiry into the missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls is something that needs to be done. So I think that is definitely a step forward on violence against women, particularly, of course, Indigenous women. And then we do see, again, commitments to ending gender-based violence. We see that, like I said, in the Green Party platform, in the NDP platform, and in the Liberal platform. I think the NDP platform has really the strongest and most robust commitment to a variety of gender-based violence, being, you know, sexual violence as well. So I think, yeah, the parties are broadly committed, those three parties, rather, are broadly committed to ending violence against women. So when we talk again about the potential minority situation, it seems like that is definitely an area of broad consensus. So perhaps in a minority situation, we might see faster and more meaningful work on that. I was also asked a specific question about my thoughts on Clinic 554, my thoughts and how the parties have kind of commented on it. Clinic 554 is the one and only private abortion clinic in Fredericton, so in New Brunswick. It also is a family care clinic as well, so it provides, so it is a family practice, so it provides healthcare services as well. And it is the only clinic, doctor's office in New Brunswick that provides specific LGBTQ care. So this has been a long-standing issue in New Brunswick, and I do have a lot of thoughts on it, to be honest with you. This was actually one of the files I worked on closely while I was in the Premier's office in New Brunswick. It frustrated me to no end, and essentially what we're seeing, what has happened is the clinic has said we can no longer operate because right now they're charging full price, or they have to charge their clients rather, for abortion services, or if they know their client, their patient can't pay for it, they waive the service, because the province has said that they won't pay for abortions performed in private clinics. This is a wide-standing policy in New Brunswick, and it is what I heard always when working on this file from the bureaucrats was that, and this is the position that you have seen in the media from the New Brunswick government as well in the last few days, is that they don't fund services in private clinics, point blank. And what I often heard, again, in some of my conversations was, essentially, this is a slippery slope, and if we start funding one service, what is to stop funding others? Which, again, like, what other private healthcare service has been upheld as a fundamental right under the charter? I honestly don't know. If there are others, maybe, I guess, medical assistance in dying. If there are others, again, like, yeah, let's talk about them. So I think that is, of course, a counter argument. So, and we've seen this issue now, again, as we go back up to wedge issues. Justin Trudeau kind of asked this question to Jagmeet Singh in the French language debate. Anyways, it was like a very weird exchange. And the whole philosophy behind that is, again, to drive the wedge, right? To show that this is a conservative government in New Brunswick that is not funding essential abortion services. They're using it as a wedge issue. You know, Elizabeth May has stood up and said that she is supportive of the clinic, and that's great. And Jagmeet Singh has as well. And then as we're recording this episode, Justin Trudeau was actually in Fredericton announcing today that he would basically use all of the tools in his power, including under the Canadian Health Act, to ensure funding in private clinics for these services in New Brunswick, which, again, is all well and good. But for folks, again, who are not entirely clear on the history of abortion access in New Brunswick, up until 2014, every single premier since the Morkenthaler decision at the Supreme Court level has fought this decision in court. Literally, they were in court with Dr. Morkenthaler for 20 years, I think, around 20 years. Every government, like I said, conservative or liberal, fighting funding abortion at all. It was only in 2014 under Brian Gallant where finally the two-doctor rule was removed, which again was like deemed by the Supreme Court 30 years ago, maybe longer, 35 years ago, anyways, as being unconstitutional. So only in 2014 were those first steps taken. And then again, access in three hospitals was provided. And that the regionality of that access is definitely a huge issue. Two hospitals in Moncton, one in Bathurst. So the regionality is, yes, a joke. So that needs to be expanded. But yeah, I don't have any idea why anybody thinks that this Blaine Higgs government is going to cave on this issue. They're not. There's no way that they are. And again, like, I think that does have to do a bit with the history of abortion access in New Brunswick. And it's super unfortunate. And I wish they would cave on it, and I wish we had have done more. And like I've said in so many episodes before, we tried so hard to do more and were hit with barriers at every single turn. But yeah, I guess overall my thoughts, that was a bigger rant than the whole episode, I think. My overall thoughts are, again, I'm annoyed that it's being used as a wedge issue. There needs to be a real solution found by all parties at the table. It shouldn't be used as this, like, hanging over, we're going to hang the Canada Health Act over. Like, again, we've got to get past this. We've got to say, like, this is a fundamental right for women, and we've got to provide that access and move on and have broader conversations about women's healthcare and actually gender-responsive healthcare in New Brunswick, because we're behind
on many things, including abortion access. So frustrated. There's my rant. I support Clinic 554, and I hope that we can come to a solution, both for abortion access, but also for the critical LGBTQ services that they provide, and for the 3,000 or so patients that they see as their family doctor. So with that, we will wrap up the episode. If you haven't yet, get out and vote. Next time you hear from me, the election will be over, and who knows what we'll be talking about then. Thanks again so much for listening. If you liked this episode, please do feel free to leave us a review. Again, we threw so much at you here, so would love to hear from you directly or on social media. You can find us on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter at FemWonk. And as always, you can always email me directly, katie@femwonk.com. Thanks.